What up, what up, what up, what up? Welcome back to the show. How y'all doing out there? You doing okay? Everybody staying safe, watching some good TV shows? Good. Gonna start off here before we get going with something kind of fun, something kind of nice that we haven't done in a while, because we've been doing a lot of, like, heavy subject matter on the show. Important stuff. Stuff that I'm happy to be talking about and conversations that I'm happy to be hosting on this show. But, you know, it's just been a little bit heavy, 'cause it's 2020. Welcome to this year, you know, the worst year that's ever existed. Yeah, that year. The year that Kobe Bryant died. You remember that? You remember that Kobe Bryant died this year? That happened this year. Doesn't that feel like a whole other, like, lifetime of terrible things ago? Because in many ways it kind of was, but it was just all in this year. We're gonna be talking about this year for a long time. Anyway, I'm gonna start off with something a little fun, something we haven't done for a while. I'm gonna read an audience review. If you're new to the show, this is something you can do. You can go to Apple Podcasts and rate the show 5 stars. Rate People Pleaser with Austin Archer 5 stars and then leave a review. Leave your name. What I'll do is read your review on the show and then review you back and say something nice about you. Today's review comes from a person who I don't know who it is, so I can't say anything nice about them specifically, which is why you need to, like, let me know who you are. But I will just, like, say, you'll see how it works. This is the review. It says, delicious content, 5 stars. Already, I love it. First of all, you have to do 5 stars if I'm going to read it. You have to go 5 stars, then leave a review. That's how it works. But delicious content, love it. The name of this person is Le Grand Jeté. So I do love the screen name, but I can't ascertain who this is based on the screen name. But the review says this: this podcast also deserves a Michelin star because the content is delicious. I'm assuming they mean a Michelin star in addition to the 5 stars they already gave me. There are moments for every flavor, and with every flavor, a thought-provoking, emotional knock at the proverbial back door of your inner self. Whether whisked away in dreamscapes, discussing neuroscience, drag, or tipping, there is something for everyone's palate. Must listen to podcast. The minisodes are also wonderful as well. This is just a wonderful review. It's wonderfully written. I love the kind of mixture of making it sound like it's a review for a restaurant or like a 5-star Michelin restaurant. I really do appreciate this, Le Grand Jeté. I love your screen name. I bet you're a really, I can sense like a kind of like a wit and a sense of humor here. So yeah, that's what I'll say nice about you. You've got like a nice little writing style and you're funny. And I like that you pointed out that the show covers a lot of different ground because we try to keep it diverse and poppin' in this blanket fort. And that's how that works, okay? Listener, if you're new to the show, you go on Apple Podcasts, rate the show 5 stars, leave a review. I'll read it on the show, and then I'll rate you back. And if you want me to say something nice specifically about you because we're homies, which a lot of the case is, it's the case a lot of the time on my show, you got to let me know who you are. Okay, that's it. Here comes the show. So here's a blunt question straight out of the gate. What is the acceptable number of teacher and student deaths you would tolerate to see schools reopened in an effort to help get the economy and the country back to full operating speed again? Is there an over-under? Under 2,000, you're in, but any more than that, you might have to reassess. Have you considered this at all? Thing is, this isn't a hypothetical question, as you no doubt are aware, dear member of the Blanket Fort Nation. This is just one of the grave, real-life quandaries 2020 Santa Claus brought us in his never-ending bag of abject horrors. In a few short weeks, schools across the nation will reopen while COVID-19 infection rates in the U.S. continue to climb. Conditions are worse now than they were when schools initially closed back in March, but we are soldiering forward with plans to reopen full classes nonetheless. In some areas with manageable class sizes, social distancing in the classroom may be achievable if the teachers are able to maintain absolute control over the children in their care 7 hours a day, 5 days a week for the next 9 months. But in areas where class sizes are in excess of 25 to 30 students a class, social distancing will be next to impossible, to say nothing of the lack of personal protective equipment and proper ventilation in many public schools. So we really do have to stop and ask ourselves here, what in the world are we doing? Are we really going to pretend that this just isn't happening? Are we going to turn very large numbers into percentages so that they seem smaller and more palatable? Is that where we're at? Is that the best we can do? Teachers and school workers across the country are very legitimately scared for their actual lives and the lives of their family members, their students, and their students' families. Having their safety in the workplace disregarded is nothing new to school workers. They've seen the inaction on gun reform after dozens of mass shootings in schools. They've attended the training sessions intended to help them learn how to best protect their kids in an active shooter scenario. They've seen our best efforts to protect them and their loved ones, and they're used to how commonly those best efforts don't come anywhere close to hitting an acceptable mark. So I guess it should come as no surprise that school boards and districts and government officials are asking them once again to go above and beyond the requirements of their job by literally putting their lives on the line in the name of projecting an image of normalcy in a profoundly abnormal time. Wendy Moss is a concerned teacher and mother in Utah, where classroom sizes are almost unilaterally overcrowded. When the guidelines from the different districts started to roll in, Wendy and other school workers in her area could instantly see that what was being proposed was dangerously insufficient. She started the Facebook group Safe Utah Schools in order to coordinate a message and a response. She and the thousands of other school workers who have joined the page have been organizing rallies, speaking to the press, and doing all they can in a literal fight for their survival. As the school year moves closer and closer and no sign of policy reform emerges, Wendy and her fellow teachers are continuing to push their message in a Hail Mary attempt at getting something school workers have learned time and time again not to expect: actual, meaningful reform and support. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to Wendy Moss about the dangers and very valid concerns around reopening schools in an active pandemic. Staying pretty busy.
Yes, I just got off the phone with a guy who's running for school board in my district. So I guess I'm being loud and annoying enough that I'm interesting to talk to. I don't know.
Hopefully. I mean, I think what you're doing is really, really cool. And I think the fact that you're trying to make so much noise around this and get so much support around it is really, really cool. Yeah, let's before we get into everything that's going on, let's talk a little bit about just kind of your background with teaching and how long you've been doing this and what grade you teach and everything like that.
Sure. So I started teaching actually in 2007. I taught for 3 years. I got my level 2 license, and then I had a baby and took some time off, and then I started again in 2018. So I had a bit of a gap there. So 5 years altogether, but also I have experience from a long time ago, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I teach sixth grade, and here that is elementary school. Yeah.
Awesome. So you're doing a lot of work right now to kind of activate awareness around this issue. And I think, I mean, like I said, I think that's really, really cool. Is doing that taking away, I mean, I'm wondering, are you spending any time right now formulating your lesson plan for the fall school year? Are you also having to like work on getting ready for reentry, or are you primarily focused on trying to see if you can stop that from happening, or convince the school board and the school districts to consider a different option?
Well, I've actually applied to teach online next year. So I can't start preparing until I know if I'm going to get one of those slots or okay. if I'm going to be in a classroom. But my district is switching math curriculums, and I've gone to professional developments about those and stuff this summer. But yeah, so everything's kind of up in the air.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening next year. So also teachers aren't paid for summer break. So I think a lot of us really try not to work too much when we're not getting paid.
Yeah.
But I mean, we do. I work probably 60 hours a week during right. the school year. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's big part of the job is you're kind of constantly doing work outside of work.
And, yes.
And yeah, I'm sure you try to... to not work during those unpaid months.
Right. Got to kind of try to set up boundaries.
Of course, yeah. But also at the same time, it's like when it comes to back to school time, I'm sure that everyone, all teachers are like, well, I'm going to at least, you know, spend the last couple weeks of summer getting ready for the return.
We do. And August is kind of mine where I start, even if I'm not getting paid for contract time, I do start trying to put together what I'm doing for the next year. It's just really hard because we're running, you know, I mean, our application period just closed last week to apply to teach online. And so...
Tell me about that. Are there positions available for teachers to teach solely online, and there were like a limited amount of
every district is different. So my district is like allocating teachers for online with the students who want to go online. Some districts are making teachers teach both, so they'll have half their class online, half their class in the classroom.
Okay.
And they're really not getting paid for all that work, so so that's, I mean, everyone is handling it differently, which I think is part of what's really frustrating for people here.
Yeah. What kind of is the plan that's been rolled out by the school districts? And I mean, you've already sort of said that like everyone's doing it sort of differently, but like what, I mean, I saw one study that I think was posted to your Facebook wall that was a survey that someone had done where, you know, of close to 1,100 school workers surveyed, there were like 77% of them said that they did not feel comfortable with their district's plan for reentry and did not feel safe going back to school. And there were just lots of different questions that were asked where, like, overall, it just looked like people weren't really satisfied with the plan that was being put forward. What's the plan that you heard being put forward, and like, where do you feel like that plan might be inadequate? Is there anything in the plan that takes into account safety measures or PPE, or is it just kind of like business as usual and try to keep your kids socially distanced and, you know, use hand sanitizer a lot?
Well, I mean, that's what it feels like to me. But but the plan that came from the state was very minimal as far as safety measures, and things like social distancing was put if possible. And So that was kind of the minimum bar the state set. And I kind of understand why they did it, because they needed to come out with a plan for all of the districts, regardless of whether they're in a low infection zone or a high infection zone. So they had these kind of minimum requirements, and then they had recommendations. And the problem that we ran into is that the school boards took those and implemented the minimum requirements. So we had one district here, Salt Lake District, that actually decided to start fully online. Salt Lake is hit the hardest. They're the only one considered orange by the governor as far as infection rate. And then, let's see, Davis has put in a split schedule. So they have half the kids for 2 days of the week and half the kids the other 2 days of the week or something. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that now is that Davis is saying that if the kids are 6 feet apart in an unventilated room, they don't need to be wearing their masks. So while that sounds good, we're not implementing all of the measures that we need to mitigate the spread of COVID. We need masking, we need social distancing, we need circulated air, ventilation, things like that.
Yeah, talk about this. That's a big concern, is that a lot of the buildings aren't up to code and don't have proper ventilation. What do you know about kind of where we're lacking in that arena, and what's the difference between a ventilated building and an unventilated building?
Well, I'm not an engineer, but a big problem in schools, at least schools here, is that their windows don't open. And that's on purpose because of the school shooter risk. So we don't want any intruders climbing in through the windows, but those locked down windows that prevent intruders from coming in also keep COVID from going out. So from my understanding, some districts are putting in filters in their HVAC systems. I think the most that I've heard any district is going to cycle clean air in every hour is about 50%. And that just didn't really seem like enough to me. But like I said, I'm not an engineer. That's why I really wanted experts to look at these plans and approve them or not approve them, just based on more knowledge than I have. So those were the things that were just concerning to me after reading some stuff about HVAC. And of course, the non-opening windows is a big one, because if we could open our windows, that might really make everything less worrisome, except for the teachers that don't have windows.
Yeah.
So,
have you had experts look at these plans and comment on them?
I have had the Utah Physicians for a Safe Environment. They went over the document and they made some really good recommendations. They said mandatory masks, you know, very few exceptions. They said social distancing in addition to masks. Most school districts are opening with a full schedule. So full class sizes, which is 30 or more kids in a room. For 7 hours a day.
How is that possible then? I mean, you can't socially distance 30 kids in a classroom.
Oh, no, you can't. I've had teachers posting photos because they've been in, like, setting up their classroom. Some teachers can get maybe 3 feet. Like, the really lucky ones can get kids 3 feet from each other. And then the less lucky ones, you know, have like 11 inches between desks.
Yeah, and so, 3 feet for how long? Like, I mean, you're supposed to control a room full of third graders for and keep them 3 feet apart from each other for the entire day. And not that 3 feet really does anything anyway, but I mean,
Without ventilation, it's kind of
yeah, it's a joke. Like,
yeah,
let alone getting them to keep their PPE on, you know? I mean, we're having a very hard time in this country getting adults to do this stuff, you know?
It's going to be really hard. I don't understand. And, you know, there is a camp of people who say kids can't wear a mask for 7 hours, and then they think that masks shouldn't be in school, whereas if we just did a split schedule, they'd only have to wear their mask for 3 hours, you know? So
Yeah.
Maybe they can't wear a mask for that long, and maybe we should split schedules so we can socially distance and, you know, but
is that not? Tell me a little bit more about that. So you said split schedule earlier that Davis is doing that. What exactly does that mean?
That just means part of the kids come for 2 days and the other part come for the other 2 days. So classes are half because kids are only in school half the time.
Yeah.
Then they do online for the rest of the instructional time.
I mean, that sounds more reasonable than full class sizes to me.
Me too.
And while it's like, it's probably not ideal, we're not living in ideal circumstances, you know? You can't just go, hey, look, this isn't the ideal learning environment for these kids, and we got it. You know, like the parents that are talking about, you know, socialization, and like that it's really important for our kids to not be deprived of their opportunity to be socialized in school and stuff. It's like, look, ideally, we want to be able to give every generation of kids kind of this like blanket best case scenario opportunity to experience the school system as if we've ever had such a thing. But we're always evolving what that is and always trying to do better. And in a circumstance like this, we've got to figure out a different way of making it work. And that to me sounds like at least a little bit more workable of a solution. What's been the pushback on split scheduling?
Well, the pushback is actually really interesting. And I think it's, so the pushback that I'm hearing from the school boards as far as split scheduling or online teaching, they kind of both have the same complaint, is not all kids have the opportunity to have a parent home with them for half the day. Kids whose parents work, maybe kids don't have internet access.
Yeah.
Kind of that's the problem that the school boards are pointing to. But we actually found, just from looking over the results of these parent surveys from a couple of our districts that have higher and lower income areas, the parents who wanted their kids in school were the parents from the higher income side of the district.
Huh.
And the parents in the lower income areas didn't. And it came down to things like health insurance. They're afraid to get their family sick. Some of them have multi-generational, you know, families living together with older, more high-risk people in the home. So the argument is that we have to serve the underserved community. And yet the way that we're choosing to serve them is by putting them in a school that has not taken the safety precautions needed to keep kids safe.
That's fascinating. See, I didn't know that the art, because you say that, and initially it sounds really reasonable that it's like, well, you know, not every family is lucky enough to have a parent home to watch these kids, and not everyone has internet access. And initially it sounds like, oh, actually that's a good point, you know, and what are we supposed to do about that? And then you go, yeah, but actually the survey results are saying that, I mean, these arguments are coming from administrators, and when you actually survey the families, it's of course low-income families that are more concerned about infection, because as we all know at this point, it's been low-income communities that have been disproportionately affected by the virus anyway.
Yes.
So wow, that's really enlightening.
it seems like a problem to me. I feel like we should be asking the families that we say that we're speaking for instead of just taking away their voice. Yeah,
that seems just so typically American, though. Seems, you know, like that we go, oh, but we're doing this in a very, it's actually an act of compassion to, to re-enter school with full class sizes, because we're helping out these families that need to go back to work and that can't be home all day long to take care of these kids. And
well, and the whole equity issue, we had 4 months to solve this. We could have gotten internet, you know, in every neighborhood. We could have partnered with the Boys and Girls Club for childcare. You know, we could have done creative solutions to help these families rather. Yeah. And that actually sounds easier to me than ripping out windows in schools and installing expensive air purifiers. You know, like, I think that there was potential for a good solution, but...
Yeah, setting up a better digital platform for teaching and setting up a better infrastructure for that is maybe as practical, if not more practical, than completely doing an overhaul on the coding for all these schools and putting in ventilators and then still putting even if you make all of these buildings up to code and you have new air purifiers in the buildings, you're still jamming these classrooms full of 30 small children, right, and expecting the adult at the helm to make sure that they all stay as far from each other as they possibly can for a full 7 hours. And
yes,
which it's just not going to happen.
it's not. Oh, we also have a modified quarantine. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
So this was new. I think this was since I talked to you before. This happened on Thursday last week, okay, where the state put out, it's like a 102-page document about managing COVID in schools. But essentially, what it comes down to is that students and teachers and food service workers in the school are kind of, it doesn't say this in these exact words, but they're considered essential workers. Mm-hmm. And so we are following a modified quarantine for the schools in Utah at this point, as far as I know, unless something changes because everyone's freaking out, which means that if a child or a teacher or a cafeteria worker has a close contact exposure to COVID-19 inside or outside of the school, and the health department calls them and says, you have to quarantine, they can't go to the mall. They can't go to the store. You know, they can't go to a restaurant. They're quarantined because they're too high of a risk to be in society. And yet the school is considered essential. And so they will be able to go to school while on quarantine due to a close COVID-19 exposure.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the new thing. And that came from the state. So on top of the whole 30 kids in a classroom, no ventilation, we now have a modified quarantine where we know that kids can be very mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic and still spread the coronavirus. So that's our newest news.
Wow. I mean, that's, and look, I mean, you've been in this profession long enough to have plenty of experience knowing that this is kind of nothing new, that like expecting teachers to fend for themselves and to basically do way more than their job description with not a lot of support and not a lot of extra financial help or programming is nothing new. I mean, there's a long history of schools being underfunded and teachers being underpaid and underappreciated just by society at large, especially in our country. But this does seem particularly malevolent. Like this, you know, it's like...
I was pretty offended personally.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't understand how anyone looking at what we know about COVID and the spread of COVID and, you know, these studies where, you know, somebody gets COVID in a summer camp and then 2 days later, 75% of the kids have it, like how this seemed like a good idea. But, you know, Utah is the only state that has a modified quarantine from what I can tell. So that's good, I guess, for everybody else.
Yeah, that's insane. And I saw a study recently, and I don't know if this is a new study or not, but it basically just said that children are much better carriers of the virus.
Yeah, like they have larger concentrations, right?
Yeah.
I saw that one too.
Yeah, and that sort of goes into what you just said, like two kids at a summer camp get it, and then 75% of the kids mm-hmm. all have it.
Yeah. And they do, they tend to not get as sick, but the thing that no one is considering is the adults that work with them, which is why this is a big problem. But also, you know what? If we're in a modified quarantine and this kid is sitting next to this other kid, and then the one kid comes down with COVID, and there's six kids who have been sitting within 3 feet of him for 6 hours. None of those kids are all considered on modified quarantine, but they will be coming into the classroom and sitting next to other kids within 3 feet for, you know, so it just seems like a really bad idea.
Yeah, essentially, it just seems like everyone eventually in the school is going to be on modified quarantine. And then it's a matter of numbers of like, well, how many people are going to become critical and need to go to the hospital? And then how many yes. of those people are going to not come home from the hospital?
Yeah. And what is our hospital capacity? Can we afford that here? I think right now our hospitals are at 60-something%. So we're getting there.
I read that that it was like an op-ed on your Facebook page that was about like, when will the ask be too much? You know, yeah. and it said, we're told to adapt, retire, or quit. Mm-hmm. And it was all these kind of ways in which teachers have been asked to be more than just teachers. They've been asked to be parents and teach the kids ethics and character. And they've been asked to be police officers and recognize gang behaviors and, you know, and intervene in violence and keep an eye out for drug crimes and things like that. They've been asked to be protectors when it comes to learning protocols for active shooters up to using yourself as a human shield to defend your students' lives. And I think a lot of people, when it comes to the gun debate, after Sandy Hook felt like, okay, if that's not going to get it done, then nothing's going to get it done. And it makes a situation like this feel very fraught, like the hope for stopping and reevaluating and getting something better done. It's like we have a long history of not stepping up to the plate when it comes to this stuff and just sort of putting the onus on teachers of like, well, we're just going to give you some training on how to deal with that the next time it happens. And it's right. like instead of really stepping back and thinking, is there a better way that we can do this? And I don't know. I just – it sort of baffles me, this notion of like breaking it down into percentages so it feels more palatable, you know? I think that's a thing we've been seeing a lot this year is like taking the numbers of people who are infected and the numbers of people who are dying and turning them into percentages and going, well, look, it's going to be like 1-2% of teachers and students who are going to get infected, and it's going to be less than 1% who are going to die. So come on, like what's really the harm? And we're talking about thousands of people here, you know?
Yeah.
We're talking about thousands of families.
Right. Yeah, I think that I think that this is scary for teachers because, like you said, with the Sandy Hook thing, that was a big thing I noticed when I left teaching, you know, in 2010 and then came back in 2018. Mm-hmm. I had to go to a training at the beginning of the school year about how to stuff a bullet hole. You know, like here's this kit that's in your classroom and here's how you use a tourniquet and like all these things that I didn't have to do back in, you know, 2008. And teachers, I mean, they've taken it, you know, they've been like, I will do this for my kids. I love my kids. I will protect them any way I can. But then... Sorry, I'm like going to cry. But then the state comes out and says, basically makes it impossible for us to protect our kids and ourselves. And that's really hard to take that, you know, like, yeah, we'll buy pencils, we'll buy markers. I bought 30 copies of A Christmas Carol so I could read that with my class last Christmas.
Yeah.
We do all these things, but then... when it comes down to them taking away all of our power to protect our kids, it's really hard.
Yeah. You know, Sandy Hook was 26 people, and and that's a, I mean, it's a huge number. It's 26 families, and like you said, teachers were willing to go, we'll do what we need to do. If that's if that's the best that if that's the best that we can be offered is training on how to stuff a bullet hole and you know, recommendations that we be willing to use ourselves as human shields, then that's what we'll do for you know, $30,000 to $40,000 a year. That's what we'll do. but we're talking about way more than 26 people here. We're talking about, you know, almost guaranteeing that just it's going to be, I think it's going to be very similar to what's going on in prisons, where with that modified quarantine, we're going to just have entire populations of like school districts who are like basically on modified quarantine together because 80% of the people working there and the students all are infected. So they're all just going to school in this building that's basically just a you know, like a quarantine zone in and of itself. Yeah, they're going to school in Chernobyl, and we've got nothing for them other than and like you said, we've always asked teachers to buy their own materials, buy markers, buy pencils, buy books, but like I'm seeing stuff online of teachers who are building their own plastic dividers between, and I'm like, what? That's insane. That we're asking them to buy their own materials for PPE and stuff. Are the Utah districts providing adequate PPE for their school workers?
No, they're really not. Most districts are providing, I think, two cloth masks for teachers. Some districts are providing a face shield. Some districts are providing like a plexiglass box to put around the teacher's desk. But I mean, as far as teachers are putting up GoFundMes for, you know, air purifiers stuff like that. And, you know, the teachers building those PVC pipe divider, you know, they're trying to protect the kids. I mean, they're not building those for themselves. They're building those so that their kids in their classroom can face each other and be protected. And so this just kind of shows how used teachers are to being self-sufficient, because like nothing is given to us. We get like, at least in Utah, we get about $175 of legislative money every year for like all of our classroom supplies. And they're just used to making it work. But this is a big ask that the state is asking. And it's really, I think some teachers are struggling to buy those things because they're like, this should be given to me. You know, you're asking me to go to work in a closed room in the middle of a pandemic. Why would you not provide this? So that's, I think that's, some teachers feel like they shouldn't have to do that. But I think if it comes down to it, they probably will, because they want to be safe. They want to keep their class safe. And for the modified quarantine, I have to say that it's, if kids test positive or have symptoms, they're on official quarantine. They can't come to school. But it's just if they've had a close contact with COVID and they don't have symptoms, they can continue to go to school. Okay. So just so you know, but okay. If I didn't explain that well.
No, that I might have just missed that, but that makes more sense. But it still seems like
they still can be very mildly or non-symptomatic, like that. Yeah, especially kids.
It still feels like the result will be higher and higher infections.
I think it will.
And this thing of asking people to buy their own protective equipment, I mean, it's like sending soldiers into war and asking them to buy their own gear. and being like,
could you just build yourself a gun out of some PVC pipe? That would be great.
Yeah, we're sending you in there regardless, but it's up to you how much equipment you want to buy. We're sending you in there. Like, you're going in there, and you can go in there with a t-shirt and jeans if you want. But if you want, we've also got, you know, like knee pads and boots and a flak jacket and a helmet that you can buy. And that's up to you, you know? I mean, like, that's crazy, you know?
Right. I did have one teacher, he said to me, these problems aren't new that we're running into with reopening schools during the pandemic, but it's making everything bigger. You know, the lack of funding means that we can't buy PPE for teachers or classrooms. And this was a problem already, but this has just made it worse. You know, inequities in internet and income and health insurance, those were problems before, but the pandemic has made it worse. So I thought that was very true.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, it's, you know, in a time when we just, the extra benefits for unemployed people, the extra $600 just expired and Congress can't seem to come to a determination on what they're going to do about that with still tens of millions of people unemployed. And then this issue of schools being underfunded, again, not a new issue, but really, really coming into focus as we're heading back in the middle of the pandemic that is still raging on. And we just approved, I think, what, $76 billion for our defense budget again, which is just kind of like, are we in a war that I don't know about? Like, what's going on? We already have the most overfunded defense budget of any country in the world by a long, long, long shot. Can we take a couple billion from that and put it toward our schools? Like,
That would be nice.
I don't understand it. Yeah, it's really crazy. This seems self-evident to me, and it does seem like you have a lot of support in the school worker community and with teachers. Like I said, that survey that said like 77% don't feel safe, and it seems like you've got a lot of support with what you're doing on social media and the kind of activism that you've got going on there. I wonder about what kind of backlash you're getting and what – if any, and what your detractors are saying and who they are, like, where are they coming from?
You know, I don't get a ton of backlash. One thing that I did hear was that a first responder made a phone call to someone in the district about me and said that I don't care about first responders who have been going to work and it's only about teachers and all this stuff. And I, you know, I feel like that's not really fair. I do care about first responders. I'm less aware of the issues that they're facing because I'm a teacher. But if someone is sending them into an unventilated room with 30 possibly asymptomatic COVID patients, then I will be the first one up there speaking for them. So that's really the only thing I've heard. I try not to read comments too much on news stories, but there's always the ones that say masks don't work, you're all stupid, bring school back to normal, full class sizes, you know. But I don't think that those are bad people. I think that they are maybe struggling a little bit with reality. And you know what? I would love if COVID just went away tomorrow and we could just go back to normal. That would be amazing. But I think that everybody wants things to go back to normal. And I think it's just going to take some time. And we're not there yet. And until we get there, we just have to keep everybody as safe as we can. That's my opinion. But not a lot of people ask me. I just talk a lot.
Well, I mean, but it's good that you're speaking up, and it's good, I think, that you're talking a lot. And I do think that you have a lot of support. And but like you said, I think some of these people who maybe have different opinions are either struggling to accept the reality or they're getting bad information. We know there's just a lot of bad information going out out there. One of the things that I keep seeing, and I said it earlier, is like people making it a percentage instead of a number. And it's just kind of like, we don't do that for other things. We don't take 9/11 and go, what's everyone getting so bent out of shape about? It was like 0.003% of the American population. Like, who cares?
Right.
You know, we don't do that. We look at it and we talk about that it was several thousand people who died.
Yeah.
And it was an event that defined a generation. And we still have safety protocols in place from that event. And this is on a much, much, much larger scale. When it comes to the first responder, that thing of like, hey, you only care about your cause and not mine. I'm seeing a lot of that lately too. And I get where it comes from, but I'm seeing people are saying, hey, Congress should extend the deadline for these extra unemployment benefits. I've had some friends kind of go, hey, what's the deal? I'm still at work right now. Like, so I still have to go to work and make less than you at your for sitting on the couch and getting unemployment. And it kind of feels like, why should we extend your unemployment benefits when I still have to go to work? And I get that. There's a lot of people feeling like, hey, you're not taking care of me. And if I'm not getting taken care of, then why should you get taken care of? And there's a and I understand that place, but it's just a matter of actually looking at it and going, hey, that's cool that you still have your job and that you're still employed. And I'm sorry that your job that you're employed at doesn't make as much money as maybe you would be making on unemployment. That's ridiculous, but also like that's its own problem in and of itself. And that doesn't mean that people who are currently out of work and have no recourse to get back to work should be out of money and out of support. You know, and it's sort of similar to this situation where it's like, we probably should be taking better care of first responders and of frontline hospital workers and of people who have been consistently working in grocery stores and, you know, like fast food restaurants. Like we should be taking better care of these people. But knowing that we should be doing a better job for them doesn't mean that we shouldn't also be concerned about teachers and students.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a little
I think that everyone just needs to help each other.
Yeah. It's a little bit defeatist to go like, well, no one's helping me, so we shouldn't help you either. You know?
Yeah.
We should be doing a better job just across the board with this thing.
Oh, we should. We should have healthcare professionals making these decisions and not politicians. That was kind of the whole source of my petition that I made was we just want, you know, doctors to look at this and just say, is this safe? Is this not safe? If Walmart is not consulting doctors and they're just making decisions based on whatever their CEO thinks, I think that would be a problem, especially for the workers. But then we have teachers who are government employees and the government only asks itself. It doesn't ask doctors, you know, so... Yeah. There's this weird thing just because we work for the government and they're not consulting the people they should be, I think.
Yeah. What would safe reentry into schools look like to you? Or what would we've talked about split scheduling and how that could be useful, but what if in an ideal world, in an ideal situation, what would it look like to you? Or would it just be, we don't go back?
I feel like at this point, our infection rate has been up around 10% this whole time. Our governor was looking at rolling 7-day average, which they wanted initially. Our epidemiologist wanted it below 200 cases a day. Then I think later that got changed to 500 cases a day. And we did achieve that last Thursday. But our testing was down by like 30 to 40%. So I don't know if that was a coincidence, but it is what it is. So I kind of started looking more at the percent of positive tests, and we've been bouncing between 9 and 11% this whole time.
Wow.
And from what I can understand by looking at like the World Health Organization, we should be below 5%. But that all depends on if you have enough tests per day. And from stuff I've read, Utah's not doing enough tests per day for the population to get a good handle on, you know, on the actual numbers. So that's a problem. So in the ideal world, I would like to see us doing enough testing and get that positive rate down below 5% and just do online until then. And, you know, face on those equity issues and childcare issues that people may need and just solve those the best we can. Make sure that our, you know, our special ed students are getting services, make sure that our ESL students are getting services.
Yeah.
And even if that means not 100% online, but like they come in small groups to get the services they need in the school. Or even if teachers can do small groups in a well-ventilated area, just to, because the online only is really hard. But I would feel pretty safe in a situation where we were mostly online and then we could bring in kids who need extra services, or we could just bring in kids a few at a time and work with them very efficiently. And then as our case numbers go down, then we could start having more people at once, I guess. That would be my ideal situation. But it would be hard. I mean, I'm not saying that wouldn't be hard on parents who need to work. It would be hard on, you know, the economy probably, because kids are in, they're out. It might be even a little hard on the kids. There's not a good solution to anything with COVID. It's just, you just have to do the best that you can. And I think that, you know, physical safety should be top priority. And then we can worry about catching kids up academically when everyone has physical safety. And as far as, I mean, the way that we're going to go back, kids are going to get sick. They're going to get worried about their friends getting sick. You know, this is not, the mental health argument is one I hear a lot, where kids need to be with their friends for their mental health. And I don't think that this is a great situation for mental health,
yeah.
Like just, you know, being worried. And I don't think teachers are going to intentionally stress kids out, but it is a stressful world that we live in. So, I mean, nothing is ideal. But I would like to see more physical distancing, more PPE, and smaller groups until our numbers are under control in the community. Because even if kids don't get as sick, they can bring it home to their parents if they live with their grandparents. So it's a community problem. It's not just a school problem.
Yeah, Wendy, I'm so happy that you're doing this and that you're speaking up, but I also just, I feel like I wish that I could stop this runaway train.
Me too.
Yeah. It just feels like we're sitting here talking and we're trying to get conversations going, but school starts in 2 weeks and nobody's doing anything. And I don't know. I'm worried. I'm worried for you and for all my friends that are teachers and for my sister-in-law who's a teacher and my cousin and just for the kids too, for my nieces and nephews. And it's really, really scary. And it's just add it to the list of scary things in 2020. But
right.
Yeah, like you said, it's like, it's not ideal, but we're not, this year, like welcome to this year, like we're doing our best and we can't mm-hmm. just pretend like this isn't happening, you know, because,
right.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough on families to try to do this in a different way. It's going to be tough on the economy. But, like, that's how this year's gone. And we just got to make it through and try to minimize casualties. And it seems like the further this we go into this year and the further we go into having an economy that's not up and running, the more and more we get comfortable with the idea of more casualties, and we keep moving the goalpost. Like you just said it, they wanted it under 200 cases a day, and then they moved it to 500, but they also reduced testing. So it's like we're just moving the goalpost of what we can stomach and what we're okay with.
Right.
And yeah, it's really scary. I appreciate you taking the time to come and talk with me. I wish we had more of a solution at the end of this conversation.
But me too.
Yeah, as you well know, that's not where we're at yet. But hopefully this can help contribute to a little bit of your cause.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, and I appreciate what you're doing out there. And I just wish you all the best, and I hope you stay safe.
Thanks so much. You too.
Okay, thanks, Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So yeah, you know, it's bleak, and there's no getting around that. It just is. Because, and I think you probably already know this, but the most likely scenario is that we are just going to go ahead and head back into the school year without really doing much to protect our students and our teachers, and we probably are just going to watch infection skyrocket, and we probably are going to have to tolerate quite a few deaths. I hate to be so blunt about it, but what's going to happen in the next few weeks that's going to make it so that that doesn't happen? And what can we do moving forward to show that we actually give a damn about this? Well, it's not my style to do this, and you guys know that. I would never do this. I don't like telling people what to think or how they should vote, but I will say this. Don't vote for Donald Trump. Don't vote for that guy in November. Vote for Joe Biden. Don't vote third party either. Vote for the other person who's going to win. Make sure that he's not president after November of 2020, okay? Just do that, because, and I talked to Wendy about this on the phone. The politicization of things like this, the politicization of this pandemic and of people dying, that somehow wearing a mask or not wearing a mask has become a political issue. It shouldn't be a political issue. It should be just a human rights basic decency issue where people who actually care about their neighbors and just want to see people be able to live and not die from a disease that could be prevented, that's where that should come from, just basic compassion and basic decency. It shouldn't be political, but it is. And people like him are the people who make it political. It's advantageous for him to make things political. I talked about this in my episode about slippery slopes. He likes to make it political because it's good for him. I don't want increased protection for teachers and students so I can score points for the liberals. Just like I don't want gun reform so I can score points for liberals and dunk on conservatives. I want gun reform because we have too many people with assault rifles in this country who keep going into schools and killing teachers and students while they're trying to just do their thing. And it seems like in other countries where that's been a problem, they've been able to get in there and mitigate the problem by coming up with stricter gun laws. We've seen that work in other places, so I don't see why it can't work here. It's not a political thing. It's a matter of common sense. If it were the Republicans pushing the idea for gun reform, I'd be on their side. I literally don't care about politics. I don't care about partisanship. But don't vote for that guy in November, because if you do, this is all just going to continue to get worse. The same way that it's been getting worse for the last 4 years and has culminated in this penultimate year of his travesty of a presidency. So yeah, it's not like me to do that. It's not like me to get on a soapbox, but there it is. There's a rare moment of soapboxing for me. You can go ahead and come at me on that. That's one of the one things that I'll say, like, I don't really care to hear your counter argument on that. Usually I want to hear feedback from you on where you think I'm at on this. But if you're like, gonna hope to write me and convince me of why actually Donald Trump is the person that people should be voting for, you can unsubscribe from this podcast and just never listen to it again. That's really fine with me. Yeah, okay, a little bit heated. All right, a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. This is scary, you know? I'm worried, I'm concerned, genuinely, for my friends and my family. And I don't know what the solution is. Obviously, an election in November is something that comes too late when schools open at the end of this month. So that's not going to immediately fix anything, but it's one of the things I can think of. And then I guess if we just continue to try to make noise around stuff like this, maybe that helps. Who knows? You know, continue to try to make noise that people still need extra assistance with unemployment because people are still not back to work, and making noise about stuff like this, and making noise about racial injustice, and I don't know, all that stuff. We'll just keep trying to make some noise and keep trying to have good conversations. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music each week, composed by me. You can listen to more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by looking up Austin Archer wherever you stream music. Got a new single out called Sweet Rejection, mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. Marmalade Music mixes and masters this show. I use Marmalade Music for everything. They're an audio engineering company that you should use for your audio project. They'll help take you to the next level above and beyond and help you just sound real legit. You go to marmalademusicslc.com, let them know that you listen to this show, that you love this show, and Chris is going to give you 20% off your first project. Again, that's marmalademusicslc.com. Let them know that you listen to People Pleaser for 20% off your first project. And okay, stay safe out there. Thanks for listening. Love you so much. Bye-bye.